Scene 12, Giles DeVore, 7:35 p.m. I had an overwhelming urge to run after her and land my shoe right on the tempting target of her buttocks, but I was just barely master of myself to the point of avoiding it. What a hell of a dust-up that would have given rise to! So I held on and felt the palms of my hands grow damp and sweaty with frustration. Of all the humiliations I had suffered that day, this one was the worst. Asimov didn't help by saying, "What do you care, Darius? You know your effect on women. Turn on the charm next time you see her, and when she crumples into your arms, step away and let her hit the ground." He thought it was funny. I didn't. What could I do but ignore him and confine myself to inner fuming? I just wish I could remember what it was I was going to say just as she left. It was going to be devastating. It would have absolutely crushed her if I could have gotten it out. But I can't remember. I tell myself that it's just as well under the circumstances that I can't, but I wish I did. Then Asimov said, "Hello, Giles, how's the celebrity?" "Hello, Isaac," said the familiar, mincing voice. I had forgotten about him. I wasn't searching for him. I had reached the point where I no longer intended to search for him. If he had kept to any other part of the large room, I would never have seen him. If he had arrived 10 minutes before, ahead of little Miss Bigmouth, I might just possibly have felt calm enough to avoid what the whole day had been building up to. If he had arrived 10 minutes later than he did, I might well have been absent, for in those few moments after that woman had left, I knew there was nothing further to keep me at the convention. Enough was enough, and Giles was there at the precise spot and at the precise time. I looked up in surprise. He was standing there, stooped a little, his arms dangling, his face hangdog. He was distinctly plumper than the last time I had seen him. Prosperity continued to go to his waist, as it so often does. His glasses were black-rimmed and remarkably like those of Asimov, whom he might have resembled distantly if he were not half a head taller, and if it weren't for his shaggy black mustache. His lower lip, visible by itself, gave him a monstrous little boy pouting look. Combine the mustache and glasses, and make his nose more curved and prominent than it was, and he would look as though he were wearing one of those Groucho Marx masks. He said, "I met Teresa Valier downstairs, and she said you were looking for me, Darius." Teresa didn't quite trust me then. She'd been searching on her own. "Then sit down," I said savagely. At this point, Asimov, apparently deciding that the role of innocent bystander was notoriously too dangerous to play, rose and said, "If you don't mind, there are some people over there I have to see." He waved vaguely and was gone. His departure didn't bother me. Giles sat down and placed his big hands flat on the table, palms down, before him. He looked as though he were waiting for me to toss him a dog biscuit. I said, "Congratulations on the new book." He shrugged. "Thanks, but it won't go anywhere much with Prism Press." "You're leaving them, I understand." "Yes, writers have to find their level," he added in his sissy tenor voice, which constantly gave rise to assumptions that he was gay, which he was not, "and Prison Press is not my level." "But it is mine, is it?" I asked. "You are free to leave too, Darius, unless it is." Insufferable bastard. "And what about Roseanne Bronstein? I understand that you're refusing to do an autographing session for her." "Has she been talking to you too, Darius?" "No, I won't. I can't stand her." "You don't have to stand her to sign some books in her store." "Look, Giles, would you like some advice?" I was still holding my temper.
"Not really, Darius."
"Then don't like it, but you'll have it just the same, Giles. Prism Press, even if it is a small house, did your first book and did pretty well with it. Someone else might have done it better, but you don't know that. You might at least stick with them long enough to see how this one goes. You owe them that much, surely. And Roseanne pushed your book when she didn't have to and when it counted. Surely you owe her a favor in return."
"Favors? There are no favors in this world, Darius. Prism Press did my first book, but what of that? They made money out of it, too. In fact, they made more than I did. And they'll make still more money out of my new book. They've had their return. And Roseanne had her return, too. And what is it they want now?" "I'll tell you. They want to ride my coattails for their own financial benefit. Is that high-minded of them? I want them off my coattails for my financial benefit. Why isn't that equally high-minded of me? We're all after the loot. Why is that noble for them and evil for me?
I kept calm even then. Amazing that I did so, as I look back at it now. And what was I after, Giles? I asked. He reddened distinctly. Then he said,
That's different, Darius. I'm aware that I owe you something. And once I'm set with a better house, you can count on a good word from me. Anything that I can do, Darius, I will.
Who the hell wanted his good word? I felt myself beginning to come to a boil. All the humiliations of the day were coming to a head, not the least the newly rankling remark of that pygmy public relations woman. He was waiting for an answer, some sign I could give him to the effect that he was a kind, loyal person and would go to heaven when he died for this good deed he was offering me. I was trying to choose the words that would send him to hell when there was a thin clatter of high heels and the distinct feel of a breeze as a woman rushed past.
"Mr. DeVore," she panted, "if we don't leave now, we'll be late."
Giles' pouting underlip seemed to tighten, a sign that his familiar mulishness was overtaking him. Perhaps the reminder of his debt to me worked upon him as his own damnable condescension worked on me. And that was his manner of facing the world when he was angry. He never fought, he never struck out, he would merely become stubborn and refuse to budge. It might be over something world-shaking or something petty. It didn't matter. The degree of stubbornness was the same, and I never knew him to shake. Why Teresa Valier and Roseanne Bronstein didn't know that as well as I did, why they thought a word from me would make a difference, I couldn't say.
"Can't you get someone else?" he squeaked, and I bet myself a somber 10-1 that whatever it was he was supposed to do, he wouldn't do it.
And by then I had recognized the woman. She was the interview secretary of the convention, Henrietta Corvus. She had been unperturbed when I had arrived too late to participate in the penny ante press conference I was scheduled for, but she seemed a lot more concerned over Giles DeVore. He was worth more than I was, obviously. She said, "It's a major taping, a network show, and they don't want anyone else. We're committed on this."
"I'm not committed on anything," he said, beginning to frown.
"They'll keep me up all hours, and I've got to be doing an autographing session tomorrow morning. It won't take more than a couple of hours, I promise. I'll see to it that they're through as soon as possible. It's only 2 miles away, and a taxi will take us there in no time." I could have told her it was no use. No amount of reasoning would sway him, and for once in his life he should have remained stubborn. Death was waiting in the wings, and it might have vanished if his wrong-headedness had remained true to him. But he said,
"Take Darius here, he'll go."
And that touch exploded me. All the spleen and all the anger and all the suppressed rage that had been flooding and ebbing within me all day rose and overflowed and blew my head off. In one gigantic moment I was going to strike back at everyone that had contributed to the failure at the press conference, and at everyone who had helped irritate me that day, from the man who stepped on my toe to the runtus who stepped on my ego. I rose to my feet and at the top of my voice said, "I won't go, you tower of flab, you poor half-grown novelist. Don't you know what your responsibilities are? One half-good book and a second that's not so good, and you think that the shoulders you have been lifted on and the free lifts you have received will go on forever. They won't. Even if they seem to, they won't. You're making enemies, you small man, and your soul is shriveling faster than your head is swelling, and that's damned fast. Do you think you've reached the point where you can ignore the whirl and coast along the Milky Way on the well-greased wheels of your own fatted ego? My God, you'll come down with a crash that will deafen the world with the sound of its own laughter. Go!" No, that's not exactly what I said. It is certainly the essence of it, but I know I put it much more strongly and with a considerably more peppery admixture of expletives. The exact words don't matter. It was all scarcely what I would have said or done in return for the small provocation Giles had offered me, were it not for all that had been done to me that long afternoon. Giles had gone dead white, and Henrietta had turned red. I was, after all, shouting at the top of my voice, and I was surely heard through most of the room, a room in which almost every other sound had died away. Even through my red haze of rage, I realized I was shouting into a sonic vacuum, but it didn't stop me. And what I did was to unseat Giles completely. I ripped him bodily out of the stubborn bog into which he had set his will and turned him about.
I wouldn't have thought anything could have, short of a gun, but nothing had ever made me release the full range of my fury at him in a public place. It was enough, and I had talked events back into the path to murder. The flagstones were shaping up well. Giles was suddenly 21 again, and managed to look up at me from a point ahead and a neck above me with the same suffering canine look he had had when we first met. He said, "No need to be angry, Darius. I'd go, except that I've got to do something first." "Oh, but Mr. DeVore," said Henrietta with a mixture of desperate cajolery and clear impatience, "we'll be late." I felt myself beginning to return to the real world. I felt a thousand pairs of eyes more or less on me. The hum of conversation was beginning to rise again as the onlookers realized that the noise had not been a preparation for fisticuffs, but a lot of conversation had to be about us. I felt ashamed and guilty and couldn't fail to realize that though Giles had received it all, he had contributed only the final push. But every emotion I felt that afternoon, whether petty or decent, pushed in the same direction. If I believed in a vengeful God and thought we were worth his notice, I'd have said he was pulling strings. As it is, I have no explanation but the endless cussedness of everything. I said testily, "What is it? I'll do it for you." I fell into the role I had filled nearly 9 years before of doing for Giles what he could not do for himself, and that pushed everything a notch further. Giles fumbled in his left pants pocket and brought out a small, transparent change purse. He studied it for a second, then brought out a red check ticket. He said, "I checked a little package in the second-floor cloakroom, the one near the..." I'll find it," I said, and took the ticket from him. "The cloakroom is liable to be closed after I get back, and I'll need the thing for tomorrow morning. Please get it up to my room tonight, Darius. It's room 1511. Here's the key." "How will you get in?" I demanded. "You can take it back down to the desk, or you can leave it right there by the package. I have another. I always ask for two keys." "Cautious, cautious. That's our Giles." He said, "Just leave the package on the bureau in the center and put the key on top of it." He was following the pressing urgency of Henrietta's arm upon his elbow and shouted back over his shoulder, "Don't forget!" I heard Henrietta say, "No, I won't leave you out of my sight, Mr. DeVore, and I'll see to it that you get safely back to your room quite early. I'll see you to your room myself." She was using a tone she would have used to a child, and I think she was doing the right thing. Then they were gone.